Longtime South Florida politician is retiring, and the Miami Heat open their new season. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton has spent close to 40 years in public service. She's been a trailblazer from the Florida legislature to the U.S. Congress. She's announced that this is her last term. She joins us today to share her thoughts about some of the current issues in Congress and to talk about her career and what's next. Folks in Gainesville are bracing for what may come. White nationalist Richard Spencer is planning on speaking tomorrow at the University of Florida. The governor has issued a state of emergency in case things turn violent. We'll get an update from Gainesville. And the Miami Heat open their season tonight. What can we expect from the team this year? That's coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton has spent almost 40 years in public service. She announced earlier this year she's not running again in 2018. She was the first Hispanic woman to serve in the Florida House of Representatives, the Florida Senate, and the U.S. Congress, and she was the first Cuban American to serve in the United States Congress. Now, she's worked with numerous presidents, and she's seen a lot of changes in the country and in South Florida. And she joins us now. Congresswoman, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Luis, thank you so much for the invitation. I love being here. And as I told you, incredibly enough, I believe that this is the first time that I have been in this studio doing, well, I know your show is new, but I do a lot of the television on WLRN, and I've done some version of public radio when it was housed in the Herald and now housed in the other Herald in Doral, but here in this studio, how is it possible?
It's an honor. It's an absolute honor to have you here.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, you know what? Let's start with this. Why are you retiring?
It's been a heck of a ride. It's been wonderful. The greatest honor of my life. But to everything, there is a season, and now it's time to pass on the baton. There are wonderful candidates, both Republicans and Democrats, running for my seat. So I will be missed for a millisecond. Everyone is going to be really impressed. Whoever wins, it's going to be a standout person. But I served in the Florida House, in the Florida Senate, and now in the U.S. Congress. It's been the greatest honor to represent our constituents. But I feel like there's a lot of other things that I could be doing. And not to downgrade this at all. It's, wow, what a privilege, what an honor. But great people coming up. Each one of them is stellar.
We'll talk about who those folks are and what you plan on doing after you're finished with your political career. But you are a number of moderates like yourself leaving the House and Senate. And I'm wondering, is Congress really that much more polarized? Is it more difficult to be a moderate today?
Well, I think it's much more interesting, I tell you that, with Trump being in the presidency and policy being discussed via tweets. It's just a different ballgame up there. But don't think for a second that whether it's difficult or more challenging or more interesting, that has had anything to do with my decision to step aside. I just think I'd like to try new things, and there are good people running. But too bad that moderates seem to be leaving, because there are very few of us around. Charlie Dent, a moderate Republican from Pennsylvania, Hershey, Pennsylvania, he announced he's not running. More people might be announcing also that they're not running. I've heard through the grapevine. And the conservative Democrats have also just about been wiped out. So the Democrat Party as a whole, and I'm going to talk generalizations, are more progressive, more left-wing, and the Republican Party more conservative, more right-wing.
Is that making it harder to reach across the aisle and work together?
Luis, I think it does make it harder. And again, I say this is broad generalization. People could tell me 10 instances when that hasn't been true, and that would probably be correct as well. But by and large, the polarizations of and the extreme nature of each party makes it difficult to reach consensus, so that common sense issues where we would think, yes, let's not cut off subsidies to lower income Americans, working Americans, it just seems like we go back and forth. And yes, we're going to do it. No, we're not going to do it. Are you willing to compromise? Is that a dirty word? People on the Republican side fear the tweet storm coming from President Trump because it hurts their base. And on the Democratic side, they fear a Democratic primary. And so they're worried about compromising or dealing, even conversing with Republicans.
If moderates are leaving like yourself, what do you have any concern about what Congress is going to look like in 2018 if you've got the right moving more right and the left moving more left?
Well, I do think that the right is moving more right and the left is moving more left. I believe that good people should step up to run. In my district, I'm very happy with that good people have stepped up to run. And I hope that they do that in Charlie Dent's district. And every time there is an opportunity, you think you can challenge an incumbent and you think you've got an opportunity, whatever, you know, I'm going to be with the Republicans. But try to encourage good people to run. And when I go to schools, Luis, and I asked them, how many of you would like to be in Congress? Boy, once upon a time, lots of hands would go up.
I was going to say, how many people say they want to be politicians?
No, we've got a bad reputation that we have earned. Our approval rating is at an all-time low. And I think that the discourse today is going to bring it down even further. He said, I mean, look what's happened today with Congresswoman Frederica Wilson and the war with words with President Trump about whether he denigrated the service of Sergeant Johnson, whether he called and didn't call, whether he knew his name. And oh, my gosh, instead of.
And you're talking about this is a story that just happened really in the last couple of days about whether or not he had contacted the family of a soldier that had fallen.
That's right. And we should honor the service of every man and woman wearing our nation's uniform, salute them. Every loss is a tragic loss. And I don't know how that call was done and handled. But to get into a he said, she said battle over, you know, the body of flag-draped coffin of this brave hero. Everything is just so uncivil these days. We just can't seem to get to a place where we can discuss the issues and not get into personalities.
Before we have to break here in a moment, but before we do that, since you're not running again, has it freed you up to just legislate? You don't have to fundraise. You don't have to worry about setting up a campaign. You can just legislate now.
You know, I've always felt that the freedom to do that. I'm one of those.
But you have to do. There is.
I'm one of those bozos who's actually enjoyed fundraising. Believe it or not, I like going to cocktail parties and eating hors d'oeuvres. It's my favorite junk food. And people write you checks if they agree with you or maybe for whatever other nefarious reasons.
But you enjoy.
I don't even mind that.
You
on
enjoy.
The job.
It's one thing to enjoy it, but it's to say that it takes time away from legislating, doesn't
True,
it?
True, but it's part of legislating as well. Why? Because when I go to a fundraiser reception, you meet and you mingle with people, and they're always giving you ideas for legislation that they want. Last night, for example, it was not a fundraiser, but I went to the Propeller Club of Port Miami, area that I represent right over here by the studio. And there were maybe 150 people. It was not a fundraiser for me. I was the guest speaker. People would come up to me and say, you know, this data breaches, it's really important that Congress gets tough on them. And then someone will talk to me about some banking regulation. And that's an opportunity to find what people think. And I do that everywhere I go, even at Checkers right here down the block.
Now I know you're a politician. You're doing it at fundraisers. All right. You know what? Hang tight. Again, this is our fall membership campaign, so we're going to take a moment here to step aside and, of course, talk to our listeners about their support of public radio. But we're talking with Republican Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton. And again, she is retiring after this, not running again. We'll continue this conversation here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio by Republican Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton, who, as we mentioned, is not running again in 2018, basically now calling this almost 40 years of public service, calling it a retirement. Got to get to the news. In the last week, the big story, of course, President Trump said that he would halt federal payments to help cover the cost of insuring lower income Americans under the Affordable Care Act. You responded immediately on Twitter. It's almost a week later. Really, where do you stand on this? But have you also heard any response to your response?
Well, we've gotten legislative whiplash, Luis, about this measure. First of all, I'm glad that you did this pledge drive, and I hope that people do call. You need public support. And so all of you listening in, if you like the program, or I just met a great guy who's got folk music on Saturdays from 2 to 5 or something like that. What a great great show that is. But whiplash, why do I say that? Because one day the president says, this is a bailout for insurance companies. I'm not going to approve it again. It's $7 billion. It's a plan to help the working poor, low-income Americans be able to afford health insurance. And our goal is to get more people insured, not to get less people insured. Fix Obamacare. Let's see what we can do to make it better, but let's make it work. It's not, it seems like the president is doing a lot to make Obamacare crash and burn so that it doesn't work for anyone.
This was a campaign promise, and it's been a promise of the Republicans for many years, repeal and replace.
But he said, but President Trump's campaign promise was, we're going to have health care for everyone. It's going to be a wonderful plan. We won't. We will make sure that pre-existing conditions are covered. He made a lot of promises. His was not a repeal and replace only. It was replace with something wonderful. And what we've seen is not so many wonderful alternatives. So let's work together. Let's not have a Democratic plan or a Republican plan. Let's have a plan that will benefit all communities. I have a very hard-hit community, and I have found now that from talking to people, wow, this is a program that people need. And we need to make sure that it's viable economically, that it can work. We need to shore up the marketplaces. We need to have competition. You know, when I used to represent the Keys, now Corbella has it, there's only one provider for that area. That's not good competition. So they can charge a lot of money. So let's get more competition, not less. And let's keep these subsidies that go to lower income Americans, the working poor. They need the help.
You know what? Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, a Republican and a Democrat, have reached an agreement to come up with funds to keep subsidizing that insurance for low-income consumers for the next 2 years. Do you support that plan?
Absolutely. And it's unfortunate that now, after hyping it, the president now says he's not in favor of it. And Speaker Ryan said he's also not in favor of it. And the president, I know that maybe many of your listeners think, oh, who cares what President Trump thinks? But remember, there's a whole other side to this country where President Trump is very popular. And when the president says, I'm not for a particular program, that's specific. He says, I'm not for the Alexander plan. Then it dampens the enthusiasm. Folks are hesitant to climb on board or even study. So the reporters have done not a scientific study, but they have called the senators. Are you for this Alexander Murray plan? And the majority have said no. So at least let's give it a chance. Let's have a debate. Let's have it go through regular order. Let's have a congressional hearing. Let's have votes and amendments. But let's not say we're going to scrap the program without having some alternative there to really help people.
Help me understand right now the dichotomy in Congress. I mean, the Republicans have the White House, they have the House, they have the Senate. So, I mean, if there's ever a time to really pass your policies, now would be it. Or at least that would be that's the idea. But we have seen a lot of conflict between Congress and the White House. I mean, help me understand really what's happening right now within the Republican Party.
And it isn't unusual. When President Obama, he had two wonderful years, I'm sure that he would consider them wonderful, where he controlled the White House, the House, and the Senate. We wish that he would have pushed immigration reform. Instead, he pushed the Obamacare, which passed without a Republican vote. And now we're doing the same thing. We're pushing a Republican alternative without any Democratic votes. And, you know, it was wrong when President Obama did it because he should work with the Republicans. And it was wrong. It's wrong when President Trump does it because we should work with the Democrats.
Do you think that President Trump is better at reaching across the aisle than President Obama was?
He doesn't reach across my aisle, but he does invite this senator and that senator for dinner, and you see pictures of them chatting in the White House. But I would say that I don't have any problems with him, with the people he invites. He needs to do that more often. He does do a better job. But one thing that he doesn't do a very good job on is the bullying and the tweets and demeaning Senator McCain's service and saying that some proposal is wacky. I mean, before he was giving out Lindsey Graham's telephone number, asking people to call him and say that he's against the Lindsey Graham plan, and now he's golfing with Lindsey Graham. The pettiness of the tweets and the policy statements via tweets, I wish that they would stop. So put Twitter down. I think he's good at establishing personal relationships. He has done a better job of doing that than President Obama. But let's get in the nitty-gritty of legislation, and let's talk about how this program could benefit Americans.
All right, let me move over real quickly. This has been a really tough summer. Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria, wildfires in California. Do you think the U.S. is doing a good job dealing with all these natural disasters?
We do, but we need to change the way that we're dealing with disasters. We can't do it like a parking meter. Oh, I parked my car here, so let me feed the meter. That's how FEMA is operating. And, you know, we had a very interesting conference call with Congressman Soto, Democrat congressman from the Orlando area. He has a lot of Puerto Ricans in his district, and I'm trying to scroll through here. It was such a depressing set of circumstances. Oh, here it is. Communications in Puerto Rico, less than 60%. The entire island is brown, not green. They need additional FEMA trucks. Water on the island. I mean, it just goes on and on. So we need, just like we need a better flood insurance plan that is stable, we need a better FEMA response fund that is stable. We can't say, oh, wildfires, let's feed the meters. Oh, hurricanes, let's feed the meter. No, we need to stabilize this. This is no way to do a budget.
What's your take on the fact that there has been criticism of the U.S. government, of President Trump, but of the government in general in the response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico? And we hear this constantly from folks there. We're U.S. citizens. Don't ignore us.
Absolutely. And, you know, from Soto's report, he says General Holland is there. The primary functions are restoring the power grid, removal of all the debris. And the governor, Rosselló, has set these guidelines, these benchmarks. By November 15th, he wants 50% of the power restored by December 15th, November 15th, and then December 15th, 95%. We were slow to react. We were slow to respond. I think that the general is doing a much better job now. But will you ever get back that time? No. These are people, these are American citizens without water, without power. I know that in our house in Pinecrest, we were 9 days without electricity and without water, and it was pretty awful. And we live in a wonderful area. We were staying with friends, and I'm sure our friends were counting the days until we got our power and water back. So I can't complain.
In
Puerto Rico, you don't have a neighbor to go to because everybody's in the same shape.
And they may not have power until December. Real quick, before I let you go, because I know you're tight on time, is what's next? You're finished after this term. What's next for you? I mean, 40 years of public service. What do you do after that?
Oh, I hope to. Maybe I'll be teaching. Maybe I'll be writing a book. I'm not a rum and coke by the beachside kind of gal. But I did want to give my phone number, Luis, if anybody wants our services. We specialize in immigration, veterans benefits, all kinds of help for our constituents. It's 668-2285, area code 305, 305-668-2285. don't kick me to the curb yet. I'm still there for an hour, for a year and 3 months.
There you go.
And come by our office. We'd love to help you. Luis, muchas gracias, amigo.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton. And again, it's her last term. She still has some time, but she is leaving after this. Thank you so much for your time
today. Thank you. I enjoyed it. I hope it's not the last.
All right. Don't forget, it is our fall membership campaign. We need your support. We'll have more coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. White nationalist Richard Spencer scheduled to speak at the University of Florida in Gainesville tomorrow. He was one of the leaders of a rally at the University of Virginia in August when a Nazi sympathizer drove through a crowd and killed anti-Nazi protester Heather Heyer. UF originally refused to let Spencer speak on the campus, but he threatened to sue and they gave permission. Governor Rick Scott has ordered a state of emergency in Alachua County.
I believe in the First Amendment rights that people have. I do expect people to be safe. I won't condone any violence. I'm going to continue to work with law enforcement to make sure all Floridians are safe. I always think of I have three primary jobs: help people get a job, make sure the kids get a good education, and keep people safe. That's part of making sure we keep everybody safe.
And about 100 people with a group called No Nazis at UF took to the Plaza of the Americas on campus this week to denounce UF President Fox's decision to allow the speech. All right, we're joined now by NPR correspondent Greg Allen. He's in Gainesville for this update. Greg, you just arrived today, but tell us, what are you seeing in Gainesville today, this again, the day before the speech?
Right. Well, you know, it's been a week of getting ready for this speech here. You know, there's been news conferences and on both sides and announcements. And so everybody's getting ready. There's a real sense here of trepidation as people wait for this event tomorrow. On campus, you'll see barricades all over the end of the campus near the Performing Arts Center where the speech is going to be. A lot of the buildings in that area are going to be closed tomorrow. Just driving around, you see state troopers and other sheriffs from all over Florida. I saw more than 100 basically marching around, just kind of getting the lay of the land, walking in groups. So clearly there's a real strong police presence on the ground here, sending a message that they're going to try to keep control no matter what happens tomorrow. And it's really hard to say at this point what they're expecting. But I think a lot of students and others here are kind of just want to kind of lay low and stay away from the area tomorrow so they don't get caught up in anything, including any violence.
Have you seen or have you heard of any white nationalists or Nazi sympathizer groups that have shown up?
So far, there's not been a strong presence. There's a student on campus, Cameron Padgett, who's been kind of the face of the National Policy Institute's Richard Spencer's group. He booked the hall on Spencer's behalf, and he's the main person you've seen. There is a lot of discussion about people coming in. Certainly, every hotel room in town is booked, but that could be with news media and the anti-Spencer, protesters. So it's really hard to know what to expect tomorrow on that side. We know they have 700 tickets, and we'll see who shows up tomorrow to claim those tickets and go in.
Do we know why Richard Spencer chose the University of Florida?
Well, I don't think we know why Florida exactly. I mean, I think part of it is that he had supporters here on campus who were able to book the hall for him, but he was an uninvited guest. They just came in and said, we'd like to book your hall. I think a key factor was that University of Florida allows people just to book their facilities. Some universities, to forestall this kind of thing, only allow invited guests to use their facilities. Here at the University of Florida, allowing outside groups to come in, it generates revenue for facilities that might be otherwise vacant. So you can see why that's an advantage, but the disadvantage is that then people can use it as a venue and say, here I am at this college campus, and gives them access to young people. And this is a large university, a very large audience here. So I think it's hard to say why he chose this university, in particular, but this is what he's done at universities across the country, of course. Texas A&M, he tried to speak there. Auburn, he did speak there. And of course, we know what happened when he spoke at Charlottesville at the University of Virginia.
And
so it's a pattern. He says it works for him.
And talking about Charlottesville, obviously the fear is the repeat of the chaos in Charlottesville. What is the university telling students? I mean, are classes canceled?
No, classes aren't canceled. Like I say, I think some classes that were in these buildings that are nearby are scheduled elsewhere or canceled. I think there is pressure on campus, though, to actually cancel classes because, as I was saying, there's such a sense of we don't know what to expect tomorrow. If I was a parent with a student here, I'd be calling them and asking them, where are your classes? Maybe you should skip, some parents might be telling their children to skip classes if they're of that age, and I'm sure some students are thinking the same thing, you know. So that we'll see what the president has to say about that. But I think they also want to send a signal that, you know, that the university should continue, business as usual tomorrow. He's sent a message that he's encouraging people not to attend the speech but to speak out. And it's really the question is not even going to be so much about what happens inside the hall, but what happens outside the hall with all the counter-protesters and if there are actually right-wing, white nationalist protesters on supporting Richard Spencer. So that's the uncertainty.
And, of course, we heard the governor declaring a state of emergency for Alachua County. That's where the university is located. What does it mean exactly when they put a county under the state of emergency like that?
Well, I think the main effect of this was to basically put all the law enforcement activities under the direction of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. You know, Richard's Swearingen is the director, and so he's in charge. He'll be here tomorrow, and like I say, yeah, there's all kinds of state troopers here, and then sheriff's departments from around the state have sent people in here. So they're all coordinated under one central authority. I think that's the main. The first effect. The other thing is that it might allow some state money to be used to pay back sheriff's departments and others who have deployed people here. So it might cover some of the security costs, which, the back of the envelope figure the university threw out was $500,000.
Is that accurate?
I think it's just a guess at this point. Looking at the number of police officers here, that I wouldn't be surprised if it goes above that. But we'll see what happens. If it's a non-event tomorrow and everybody's home by the end of the day, then maybe that's low. I mean, maybe that's high for all I know. So we'll see.
Well, campus police have released a list of forbidden items in the area close to where Spencer is going to be speaking. It includes not only, of course, weapons, but signs, water bottles, bandanas, and tobacco products. How are people reacting to that?
Well, it's interesting. In one place, when you drive into town, there's a banner over the street with says prohibited items, with all the list of prohibited items on a banner. So it's kind of it's a welcome to Gainesville. Here's what you can't have here tomorrow. The one thing we've heard, a lot of this stuff is stuff. It's common sense, obviously. No weapons. No masks is an interesting thing because, of course, a lot of people do like to wear masks, including a lot of people who are the anti-fascist protesters. The anti-white nationalist people. Sometimes they say it's because of their fear of tear gas. But, so masks are prohibited. That's a little unusual. Torches, of course, we remember the tiki torch procession. So, they shouldn't be allowing that if that happens tomorrow. But the things that are a little bit more out there is things like, backpacks and purses. Okay, that's kind of like, like when you go into an airport or Disneyland, you could kind of imagine they're going to want to search them, but they say you can't have them. The one I think that gives people the biggest pause is water bottles because, it's nearly 80 degrees, or it's over 80 degrees here in Gainesville, and it's going to be a hot day tomorrow. The counter-protests start at noon tomorrow, so, yeah. I think people are wondering what they're going to do. That might be a bigger health and safety issue to not have water bottles out there tomorrow, so that's probably the most controversial part.
Greg Allen is NPR correspondent. He's in Gainesville covering the Richard Spencer speech, which is tomorrow at the University of Florida. Richard Spencer, of course, the controversial white nationalist who was also linked to the Charlottesville speech where there was violence that broke out between protesters. Greg, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right, we'll have more coming up on Sundial, but let's not forget, it is our fall membership campaign, so let's take a moment to, of course, thank you for your support, but ask you, if you haven't done it yet, why? More coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the Miami Heat opened their new 2017-18 season tonight in Orlando. They're taking on cross-state rivals, the Magic. Miami finished last season barely missing the playoffs, but they made some changes, and there's some excitement about this team. Question is, what can we expect? Well, I spoke with Manny Navarro. He's the Miami Heat beat reporter for the Miami Herald. He's in Orlando, and we started by asking him, what might we see that's different in this year's team?
Well, that's the burning question. Are they the team that finished 30-11 last year, or are they the team that started 11-30? The roster is basically the same. You have 11 players back from the team that finished the second half of the season 30-11, and we'll find out just how good this Heat team really is. I mean, I think we all saw what a great run they went on over the second half with a healthy Dion Waiters. They've added a good player from Boston and Kelly Olynyk. They drafted Bam Adebayo with their lottery pick, and, you know, this roster looks deep, it looks talented, and I think the excitement level is very high, and I think the expectations are the playoffs. The question is, will this be a team that really contends in the Eastern Conference, or is just content with making the playoffs and being another one of the teams in the middle of the pack?
Miami picked up Kelly Olynyk of the Boston Celtics, but what exactly does he bring to the team that we didn't already have?
Well, you know, I look at him and I think of Pat Riley and the disappointment they had with Josh McRoberts over the years, right? With the injuries that McRoberts had, and how you had this talented big man who could create offense for his teammates, could score himself. He's sort of a unique tool, Olynyk is. He's exactly what they wanted Josh McRoberts to be. You saw it this preseason. Eric Spoelstra started him for four games. Actually, three games at the power forward position next to Hassan Whiteside. And you saw how dynamic he can be, bringing the ball up the court, scoring, hitting three-pointers from the corner. He is a very unique weapon and somebody that I think was unexpected to be signed this summer by the Heat, but he seemed to have fit in well so far.
Hassan Whiteside started to show some maturity, some leadership, but what can we expect from him this year?
Well, I think if this Heat team is as good as advertised and they're a playoff team and, say, a top-five team in the East, I think you can expect an all-star season from Hassan Whiteside. Look, he led the league in blocks 2 years ago. Last year, he led the league in rebounding. I think he's finally going to start to get his due if this team wins and is one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference. I think the next step for Hassan is making sure that he doesn't have off nights, the nights where he comes in and he doesn't look motivated. He showed during the second half of last year he was very motivated. He didn't have those kind of nights, but you just don't want to see him take a step back. And I think the little preseason altercation he had with Joel Embiid of the Sixers, who basically called him soft, it looked to me like Hassan was really a mature individual, the way he handled that whole situation and spoke about Joel Embiid afterward and how it was sort of a fun, you know, a funny thing to him. I think it shows you how much he's grown. I think the old Hassan Whiteside would have gotten angry. He would have said some things and fired back. But instead, he took it in stride and he kind of showed us just how much he's grown in the past year.
So much attention is on the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Boston Celtics. Really, where is Miami in the race for the postseason and in the East?
Well, I think most of the experts have them in the middle of the pack. I think anywhere from 5 to 7 in the Eastern Conference. You look at the teams that are rebuilding this year, the Atlanta Hawks, the Chicago Bulls, the Indiana Pacers. Those are three teams that finished ahead of the Heat last year. Let's just assume you take those guys out. The Heat finished 9th. Well, that puts them 6th in the Eastern Conference now. So to me, I think in a good year where everything comes together for this Heat team, especially after the injury to Gordon Hayward last night, I think this team could finish as high as 3rd in the Eastern Conference. I think that the two teams that are clearly better than them are Cleveland and Washington. I think Toronto, Milwaukee, teams that finished ahead of them in the playoffs last year, we're going to have to see how those teams come back this year and how good they really are. But I think best case scenario, this Heat team could be the 3rd seed and maybe a 50-win team.
They did finish strong last year, but they started off really slow. What did they learn from that so they don't start out like that again?
Well, I think, you know, experience, exactly what they went through, knowing that that they had to build chemistry and get guys on the same page. I think the fact that they went 30-11 over the second half has given this team a lot of confidence, and they're going into the season knowing what the winning formula is. I think there's so many teams in the NBA, especially with so many moves in the offseason, it's hard to figure out, okay, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to share the ball? This team already knows that. So if they get off to a slow start, it's only because guys are fighting over the basketball and fighting over roles. I think if they just come back and do the same things they did in the second half of last year, where it's Goran Dragic and Dion Waiters feeding everybody else and setting them up for baskets, then I think this team will get off to a great start, and I think they could have the type of season that fans in South Florida get excited about, because they're going to be contending.
And again, that's Manny Navarro, Miami Heat beat reporter for the Miami Herald. Spoke to him earlier this morning. He's in Orlando, where the Heat will tip off the beginning of their new season against the Magic. And that's the program. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. Remember, it's our fall membership campaign. We need your support. let me turn things over to Peter Maritz and Bonnie Berman.